welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson with my host, Celia Farber. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome a very special guest. He's a brilliant, well-informed, and perhaps most important, sane voice in a sea of borderline, if not outright, insanity. And this is my opinion, not necessarily his, consisting of the U.S.'s current activities with respect to Iran, as well as press coverage of those activities, now ratcheted up to a near nihilistic fever pitch. Mr. Trita Parsi is the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, an organization dedicated to strengthening the voice of Iranian Americans and promoting greater understanding between the American and Iranian people. He's written important books analyzing American foreign policy with respect to Iran, books like Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States, and another book titled A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, both of which have been praised among the high-level cognoscenti in Washington. He's a frequent guest on mainstream TV news programs and should be, in my opinion, a more frequent guest. And if one could dream in color, in mine, he'd be replacing Bolton as Trump's national security advisor for the Middle East and saving us from ourselves. Welcome, Trita. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for that very, very kind introduction. A lot of things I would like to tone down, but one thing I have to correct is that I'm no longer the president of the council. And I stepped down last year, but I am the founder and I'm still involved in helping out.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, you're writing some very important pieces in these various magazines, and I have to tell you that you're one of the few people. By the way, Celia, you know, he's Swedish-Iranian. He was reared in Sweden. Celia, my co-host.
Pratar du svenska?
Yeah, absolut.
Ja, jag med. Växt upp i Sverige.
Well, enough of that. We don't understand. Okay. So, but the great thing about Trita is he knows the history. He understands the importance of historical context, and he brings it up a lot in his works. And so I would ask you if you could first, Trita, sort of lay down an historical account that's relevant to what's going on right now. I mean, you know, you don't have to go all the way back to Mossadegh or anything, but give us a brief recent history of the foreign policy and the players so that we can understand how we got here.
Sure. So let me, in that case, start off by explaining how the Obama administration ended up striking the nuclear deal and the things that they came to understand were important in order for diplomacy to work, and how the Trump team has completely reversed that and are pursuing something that has all of the hallmarks of proven past failure.
Right.
The Obama administration came in and at first really thought they could just negotiate with Iran. They gave a limited attempt in 2009, didn't end up working, mainly because of problems on the Iranian side. And even though this probably was not where Obama was hoping that he would end up, he quickly found himself essentially with the same tools and instruments as the Bush administration, which was sanctions, all kinds of pressure, cyber warfare. And he had the same results. But there was one big difference. Because Obama had given a limited attempt at diplomacy, he had the ability to get a larger coalition of countries to buy into his sanctions by being able to say, look, we tried diplomacy, it didn't work out. And now we have to go for this tougher route. And he really imposed really strong sanctions on Iran. The Iranians were under a tremendous amount of economic pressure.
What sanctions did he impose?
Everything from oil, everything from financial. Many of the things that Trump is doing right now is just a stronger version of what the Obama team already had put in place. The Obama team was also a little bit more sensitive, I would say, about making sure that they left some breathing room for the population They did not want to be accused of having done to Iran what the Clinton administration did to Iraq with all of their sanctions on Iraq.
Right.
But what happened was that it's not as if, you know, the U.S. side was building leverage and imposing sanctions and pressuring the Iranians while the Iranians were just sitting there doing nothing. They did their own escalation and their own leverage building. Mm. And their leverage building was that they directly responded to the sanctions by expanding the nuclear program. This was very deliberate. They wanted to send a message. Sanctions will only get you more centrifuges and more enriched uranium.
Right.
And so this competition started, this race between, on the one hand, the American sanctions policy in which the U.S. was trying to crush the Iranian economy and get them to capitulate on the nuclear front and essentially give up their nuclear program, and the nuclear clock on the Iranian side, in which they were trying to present the U.S. and the international community with a nuclear fait accompli that would have gone so far in their nuclear program that it couldn't be reversed. What happened was that by 2013, the president realized that his strategy was not working, that the Iranians could expand the nuclear program faster than Obama could crush their economy. And if they just kept going at that same pace, no change, the United States would soon be left with only two options: either accept a de facto nuclear Iran or go to war, unless something changed. And the thing that could change is that they could go back to the secret negotiations in the country of Oman and do something they hadn't done before, which was to actually offer a concession. Instead of increasing the pressure, offer to accept the Iranian red line. And the Iranian red line was that it should be able to keep enrichment of uranium on its own soil. They view that as national
security.
Right that they had.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Security, and better right that they had that they were not willing to give up.
Right.
Obama accepted that in secret negotiations in March of 2013. And that's what actually opened up the nuclear issue. This is even before Rouhani was elected.
Mm-hmm.
The official narrative in Washington, of course, is that, oh, you know, Obama had such strong sanctions and the Iranians essentially caved. Reality is when you actually see what happened in the secret negotiations, it's frankly kind of the opposite. They stood very firm. Obama realized that this is not worth going to war over, and he then decided to accept the red line, which I think he was going to do anyways, but he was not going to do it as an opening bit of a negotiation.
Right, right.
Now,
interesting.
When Trump came in, he was being fed a line by these Saudis, by the Israelis, and others who wanted to see the U.S. and Iran to go to war with each other, which read, Obama's biggest mistake was that he actually ended the sanctions too quickly. If he had just gone with the sanctions for another 6 months, the Iranian economy would have completely collapsed.
And so this is it this, you wrote about this in your article, America's Confrontation with Iran, right?
Yes.
And you literally said that Trump was conned.
Yes. I mean, he was, because I do believe that he actually probably would prefer to have negotiations. He just thinks this is the way to get to negotiations, and it is not at all. And this is not what happened last time. But the people who have been convincing him of this and who have been pushing this know very well that this would not work, but that instead it would lead to a military confrontation. And they're perfectly happy with that because that actually is their objective. That is what John Bolton has said that he wants for the last 20 years. That is what Pompeo counseled Trump to do last Thursday, and Trump didn't take his advice. That is what the Israelis have been doing for the last 20 years. That is what the Saudis have been doing for the last 15 years. In fact, the former Secretary of Defense of the United States, a Republican who served both Republican Democratic administrations, Bob Gates, said to his French counterpart in 2010 that the Saudis want to fight the Iranians to the last American.
Everybody wants, you know, the Americans to fight the Iranians, to the last American on their behalf, you know? I mean, is Israel, isn't that what Israel would like to see?
It certainly is what they have, at least the Likud faction in Israel, have been pushing for. And now they're very close to it. I think that the tragedy in all of this is that Trump seems to recognize that they are pushing him towards war. And he pushed back at the last minute on Thursday.
Yeah.
But then he still continues to follow their advice when it comes to maximum pressure, not recognizing, apparently, that it is the maximum pressure that is the reason why he's constantly on the brink of war with Iran.
Right, right. Wow.
But, you know...
It's schizoid, kind of.
It's so bizarre. What's bizarre... When I read your line where it says... Where you said he was conned by his national security advisor, John Bolton, his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, Israel's Prime Minister, Netanyahu, Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Emirati Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed. I mean, I was just like conned into ordering a military. So I just thought to myself, what a collection of advisors, you know, and how can he not see through that?
But Trita,
Just one point on that. I was on Democracy Now! Early this morning, and they played a clip in which Trump was saying that, you know, don't worry about Bolton because I have doves and I have hawks.
Right.
Who are the doves?
Yeah.
He has around him. He doesn't have any.
Ironically,
doves.
It's Trump himself at this point.
At this point. And even if we were then to accept the notion that it is Trump that is the dove here, does he have anyone around him that ever in their life have advocated diplomacy with Iran, that have favored diplomacy with Iran?
Well, I was about to ask you that exact question. Do you see anybody?
Not a single person there have ever engaged in diplomacy because they have never favored it. They have accused people who have engaged in diplomacy of being agents of Iran.
Well, didn't you?
So is he actually going to shift towards negotiations? When
he has no one to shift with.
He has no clue how to do it. But this is a very dangerous situation, regardless of whether his intent is diplomacy or not. He doesn't know how to do it, and he doesn't have anyone around him that could help him.
Well, what about the Pentagon? What about the military? I mean, what's their stance? I mean, the big boys.
I think they're very disinclined to favor military confrontation. They know very well that this would not be an easy war. It would lead to a lot of casualties. There's no clear reason why the U.S. should be in this war. I mean, we had a fully functioning nuclear deal. This entire crisis is a completely fabricated crisis. We had a fully functioning nuclear deal. The Iranians were abiding by it. There was no risk of a military breakout by the Iranians. And then he came an unresolved and resolved issue. So why should the next American son or daughter be sent off to die in a completely unnecessary war that Trump is essentially starting because he hates the previous president so much and is willing to take the country to war to prove it?
Well, I don't think he is. I don't think that makes sense. But what about the blowing up of the tankers, you know, or damaging the tankers? What is your take on this? I mean, do you have any inside information that nobody else has on what really happened?
I don't have any inside information. I think it is somewhat of a mystery in my mind still. I mean, without a doubt, it could very well have been the Iranians. There's some question marks in my mind as to why they would have done this. I think it's also plausible that it could have been some of these others that want to see a military confrontation. And I think it would be really valuable to make sure that we actually had a proper investigation, whether by the UN or someone else, to really know what happened, because so much of what the next steps here are going to be depending upon what happens, what actually happened with the tankers and what happened to the drone, etc. And we're faced with this very bad situation in which most of these actors have a horrible track record when it comes to speaking the truth.
Right.
I mean, John Bolton is a serial fabricator. He has fabricated intelligence and put forward lies on numerous occasions to drag the United States into war.
Well, he and that whole neocon crowd did that during the run-up to the war.
Can I ask a very naive question? Why do they want a war with Iran?
So my previous article for The Nation, I answered that, and I asked that question and answered it best I could, which is, if the end game of their escalation is war, what is the end game of their war? And the end game of the war ultimately comes down to the fact that this is a faction inside of the U.S. government with allies in Israel and Saudi Arabia whose end game is military domination, that believe that the United States has to remain the military hegemon of the Middle East for the foreseeable future. most American strategists have in the past 15 to 20 years started to walk away from that notion, partly because it's far too costly, partly because it is the region is no longer as strategically important as it was before, partly because some people believe that the real challenge to the U.S. is going to come from East Asia, and as a result, the U.S. should not bog itself down in the region in the manner that it currently does. But this specific faction believes that the U.S. should always be the military hegemon of the Middle East, and they are strongly supported by the Saudis and the Israelis, whose security to a certain extent is based on the fact that the U.S. is providing them with their security and paying for it, and they don't want to lose that privilege.
Who are the leaders of this faction here in the United States?
Right now, clearly John Bolton, who's more of a just an imperialist rather than a neocon who just wants to dominate every corner of this planet.
Right.
And I think more and more people are starting to question, you know, is that really good for the United States? Forget about the fact that it's probably not good for anyone else outside of the U.S. who doesn't want to be dominated. But is it even good for the United States to have this posture? We have more than 850 military bases around the world. Do you know the country that has the second largest number of foreign military bases?
No.
Take a wild guess.
England?
That's what I would guess, too.
No?
Israel?
No. No.
Who?
Russia and France are on a shared second space. Do you know how many bases they have?
How many?
Take a wild guess.
Like in the 20s or 40s? I don't know.
They have nine each.
Nine each. Yeah. So, yeah.
Nine each.
But you see, I have to tell you, Trita, I really think that with the Iraq war, with what went on in Syria particularly, I started getting the feeling that some of these other major countries like China and Russia are just getting fed up with this hegemonic agenda, and they're stepping in where they can, wherever they can too, you know? I don't think that, and going after Iran, I don't think they'll just be fighting Iran alone. You know, I think the Russians will help the Iranians, and I think maybe even the Chinese will. What do you think?
I don't think that they would love to end up in a military confrontation with the U.S., but I do believe that they, in such a scenario, likely would give the Iranians certain aid to make sure that this could not be a quick victory for the U.S., which it wouldn't be anyways, and they would drag the war out longer and bleed the United States even further. Already the Russians have come out. They have blamed the U.S. for the downing of the drone, saying that their data showed that the drone was inside of Iranian territory. They have questioned the case that the U.S. made to the Security Council about the tankers, saying that it's unconvincing and unprofessional. And they have completely blamed the United States for this conflict thus far, and they even taken a harsher tone vis-a-vis Israel. So certainly they're pushing back. I don't know if they would actually put any of their own assets on the line, but it's not unusual for countries to step in and give other forms of aid to the fighting parties rather than actually giving them military involvement, their own military involvement.
You know, this is... I'll tell you, I didn't realize, I mean, obviously everybody has sort of a general understanding of how dangerous this game is. But when I was reading the press reports on what happened there with the drone, that the drone was flying in international waters in the Strait of Hormuz, I started doing a little research, and it turns out the Strait of Hormuz is about 39 kilometers wide, and it's not international waters. 12 nautical miles, or 22 kilometers, are Iranian territorial waters, and the other 12 nautical miles are Oman's territorial waters. So how can you be in international airspace over the Strait of Hormuz? Now...
There's a conflict about that. I don't think the U.S. government recognizes that definition.
Well,
and they believe that there is a small sliver in the middle that is neither Iran or Oman. And I think the Iranians clearly don't recognize that. I'm not sure about the Omani position on that. But in and of itself, it is interesting in the sense that there's even a definitional dispute here.
Well, And that's a very, very important one because, you know, if you're in somebody's if you're in Iran's territorial waters, but that being said, Iran could, without firing a single shot at, you know, the Americans, okay, or an American ship or whatever, they could, if they closed down their part of the strait, you know, and wouldn't, and yeah, did not allow any ships or what, that would cause a huge global economic crisis, wouldn't it?
Oh my God, absolutely. I mean, this would, the average American will lose a tremendous amount of money and income over this because gas prices will shoot up, that which will potentially then lead to depression or at least a slowing down of the economy in China and elsewhere, and demand for American goods will go down. Now, this will have significant ripple effects on the world economy.
I don't think that people understand. I mean, when I say the insanity of it, I mean, maybe you don't see it as to be as dire as I do, but I really, really think that Iran is a I think people think, oh, it's just another one of those countries like Iraq. First of all, look what Iraq turned into. You know, let's not even go into the specious reasons for going there. But Iran has, I think, much more power to wield against us in ways that could change this nation for a very long time, if not permanently.
Oh. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think also what we have seen just in the last couple of weeks is that the capabilities the Iranians have are more than what we expected them to have. Moreover, they have prepared themselves for a potential war with the United States for a very long time because that's been the main threat that they face for the last 30 years, in which they've been afraid that the United States would do some form of invasion of Iran. And they have been quite effective in preparing for that to the extent that in the year 2000, the Pentagon ran a game, a war game, in which they were trying to game what would happen if there was a confrontation with Iran in the Strait of Hormuz or in the Persian Gulf. It was called the Millennial Games. Well, within the first 4 hours, the Iranians had sunk 16 American ships. They actually ended the war game and changed the parameters because the outcome was so disastrous.
Wow. And so John Bolton has never seen this this report. He's never... I mean, I don't understand...
Why is he in that position, Bolton? You know, that's
what's
Well,
so what I don't understand is why people like John Bolton have this... They imagine the United States to be far more powerful than it is. I mean, just because you have more military toys does not necessarily make you more powerful, you know, and you become less powerful when your enemy is further away and sophisticated, because the Iranians are, I mean, the Persian culture and the Iran, that's a very sophisticated...
Well, and that's actually what Trump is sounding like. What I heard from what he said in the press conferences in the last few days is he wants nothing to do with this, and he's assuring the American people, you know, I'm listening to all sides, but don't worry, I make the decision. And what I heard between the lines is that he wants nothing to do with it.
Then
you guys can disagree with me.
But why bring in John Bolton?
Well, that is the big mystery. I don't know. Is he just, you know, he does all this 5D stuff or whatever it is, where he has people, you know, enemies closer and all of that. So maybe he just is humoring John Bolton and keeping him close and never going to give him
Pompeo.
Never going to give them the wars that they want.
Yeah, he's got Bolton and Pompeo there in very prominent positions. I mean,
I'm just saying Donald Trump is not into unnecessary wars that carry on for years and kill a lot of people. And he's not a
no. I get that,
right? So.
So
that's
Trita,
hopeful.
What
do,
is your...
Trita, do you agree with me about what I just said, essentially?
I agree with you that is a very strong instinct that he has, but this is a very contradictory person. He has other instincts as well.
Right.
And perhaps more importantly, he has impulses that he does not seem to be fully capable of controlling. So there's an instinct that doesn't want him to go in this, and I think he's made that clear on various occasions, and he certainly made that clear on Thursday. But then on Friday, he then doubled down on the very same policy that brought him to the brink.
He likes to do that little flip-around thing that he does, where it's just keeping everybody on edge, right? Like saying, I can change my mind, watch this, somehow.
Yeah, but in this situation where a hair trigger situation that you're building up here.
Oh, I know.
And Trita, could you give me your assessment of Pompeo? What is your assessment of him, and particularly
with Pompeo? Has tried to position himself as someone that is not as hawkish as Bolton, as someone who is much better at channeling Trump and making sure that he's serving Trump. But it's also very clear that his own instincts and his own preference are very close to that of Bolton and not that of Trump. Because when push came to shove this past Thursday, Bolton and Pompeo jointly were championing and counseling war, not restraint.
Trump was still saying they work for me, you know. Trump was still saying they work for me. I decide, don't worry. You know, he was still saying that. He was still being...
He will still say that, but take a look at Venezuela. There, both of them also dragged him into this regime change situation, thing that he had argued against during the campaign, saying, oh, I would never go with that, but then he did. And he was even talking about using his military in Venezuela. Then he was very frustrated because it turned out that Pompeo and Bolton had been completely conned by various interests that wanted to do this, including some Venezuelan opposition figures who were over-promising. And he's very frustrated with it. But did he do anything to change it? Has he shifted his policy on Venezuela? No. Guess what he did? He stopped paying attention. He grew tired of the issue, as if it will go away just because he doesn't pay attention to it. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, he's very ADD that way.
Well, I mean, but let's look at this because... You know, Iran is really being squeezed right now, right? I mean, they usually export around, 2.5 million barrels a day, mostly to Asia, right? And now they're down to 400,000. That's one hell of an economic squeeze. How long are they going to stand for this?
Well, they were tolerating it up until this last round of sanctions. And they were probably just hoping that they could tolerate it until Trump left office. But two things have changed. A, I think they may have changed their assessment as to whether Trump will be a one- or two-term president. But also, Trump started to go after all of their oil sales, and that they cannot tolerate. And that's part of the reason why this has escalated into a conflict now. It's because of the very initial decision by Trump to pick a fight about this issue. Friends, I do have to apologize. I do have to run at this point.
Oh, we're really sorry to see you. I have so many other questions for you. I really do.
Thank you so much for joining us. That was
so
fascinating.
Thank you.
So illuminating.
Yeah, really.
Thank you so much. Talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, you know, I just, this is why I like to talk to Trita Parsi, because he's just very measured.
Yeah.
There's this weird disconnect that I feel. You know, on one hand, he's like, oh, yes, I have hawks and doves. But the people at the forefront are John Bolton and Pompeo.
Yes.
Okay? They're the ones traveling over to the Middle East. And, you know, Bolton is the national security advisor for this particular issue. The press, you know, is, again, they're sort of... pushing, you know, Iran as, and because one of the things I wanted to ask, talk to Trita about is he said, you know, in his second book, he talked about how hostility and enmity towards Iran has been institutionalized in the U.S. Mm-hmm. government. So there's this mindset that has been created.
Right.
Okay. And it's supported by the press. You know, Iran is some boogeyman, just like Iraq was, and so on. And I don't see anything that Trump is doing that is going to change that.
Right.
And then you also have these very entrenched, powerful interests who want to subjugate the Middle East.
Yes, but what should the Trump card, the saving grace may be how much he does not want a disastrous war to sink his presidency. How much he wants to be...
Do you hear what you're saying, though, Celia? That he doesn't want a war to sink his presidency.
But if that's all that's standing between us and this crazy war, I'll take it.
I understand, but do you understand how...
How nuts that is? Of course I do. I'm just reaching for what might we, you know, he's surrounded, as we established, by these hawks, right? Who want to go to another unnecessary war over nothing, over who knows. American people don't want it.
It's not over nothing. It's not over nothing.
As far as the American people are concerned, it's over nothing. What these guys are going to war over.
I mean, American people who may not know the history or who may not, for example, you know, that whole manifesto, the Project for a New American Century, where they wrote this agenda, you know, about, and the agenda was all about subjugating one Middle Eastern country after the other.
I know,
Trita mentioned it when he was on here about the U.S. as the hegemon. Why do we want to? Why does the U.S. want to be the hegemon? Well, I mean, obviously, the oil cannot be ignored.
I just feel like Trump doesn't really have a feel for that. He doesn't really speak that language. As recently as Thursday, I guess yesterday, he was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I heard him say, I hated the Iraq war. I was always against that war, and I think I've been vindicated. So he's standing straight up and saying what nobody's allowed to say.
But if he's saying that...
Yeah. Then why does he do this schizoid thing and go, that I can't explain. That's his pattern. He's not consistent isn't even the word. He's not integrated.
Right. And that's terrifying in this particular situation.
Yes,
because
it is.
In this particular situation, it's not even just the United States and you know, Iran clashing and, you know,
so there are like
of
two of
lost.
Him, you know, there are two of him.
Well, I mean, the real Trump is a guy who probably just wants to do business with everybody.
Right.
You know, and if you're going to fight, it's going to be a fight for resources in a business type of way.
Yes.
You know, but now he's dealing with, I think part of his situation is also, I mean, I have no idea why he brought John Bolton on as national security.
Well, nobody has any idea.
You know, yeah. But he's got Pompeo and Bolton. He's got a Pentagon. And the Pentagon, ultimately, I have to say, I think the admirals and generals do hold the power,
mm-hmm.
You know, because they have the guns. And yes, you know, this is supposed to be a democracy and, you know, the president and Congress decide if and when we go to war. And that's another thing as a result of you know, 9/11, you know, the president under the war on terror, under the guise of war on terrorism, you know, all of a sudden the president by himself can decide he can, you know, launch a conflict, you know, under those circumstances. I mean, Congress has been sidelined. I mean, Congress was pretty much sidelined during the run-up to the Iraq War. But this is, like, exponentially more
yeah.
serious.
Yeah.
It's exponentially more serious. And I'm just stunned at how the press is covering it without looking at the possible consequences of it.
Well, you've probably read more of how the press is covering it or watched and listened than I have. How are they covering it, would you say? Because our press is very centered around ourselves and our president and our you know, we don't really look outside.
The institutionalized...
We don't, for example, interview Iranians on cable news shows or...
Exactly.
Like we just spoke to somebody who's actually Iranian. So we're in a bubble all the time.
Well, he's not Iranian. He is. He's Iranian-Swedish.
Iranian-Swedish.
Dual citizen.
Okay.
With permanent residency here in the United States. But I guess...
Well, just with Iranian...
Yeah,
background. Who can even discuss? That's what upsets me so much. And I see when I watch cable news, whether it's the left or the right or MSNBC or Fox, and we talk about, and we have these crises and global conflicts, and we think we're going to war, maybe we are, maybe we're, but we never have anybody from one of those countries on those shows to put it in context
for
us.
No, you can't, because they're the boogeyman. You can't have the boogeyman's people on the show. You know, I mean, look what happened.
It's like, is there a ban on having people, non-Americans, help illuminate us?
No, it's not a ban on Americans. if the person is allied with the enemy, you may not have the enemy's spokesperson.
But that would be very illuminating.
Well, of course it would be very illuminating, maybe too illuminating.
Right.
That's the problem.
Right.
And, you know, that's how you get marginalized if you that happened to Ashley Banfield, I guess, when she, was it Ashley Banfield? I forget. But journalists have had that problem where they've talked to people from the other side and, you know, that's it. You get smacked on the hand or worse. So I think that you can't even get right now, because of what Tarita called the institutionalized hostility, you can't even get the press to report on Iran as if Iran were not the enemy. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You understand, there's in the background, the atmosphere is, it's a given that Iran is the enemy, you know. And, you know, the interesting thing about it is, if you really dig deep and look at it, here the United States, the only country in the world to have actually used nuclear bombs
right.
on another country,
yep.
is the arbiter
I know.
Of who can and can't have a nuclear arm, you know. And
yeah, that's the elephant in the room, isn't
it?
It's never discussed. Never.
And the other thing that's never discussed is most of these countries that have developed, you know, even the enemy countries that have developed nuclear weaponry have developed it using General Electric, an American company, specs
mm-hmm.
and licenses. And what happened is, after the United States signed non-proliferation treaties, you know, what they did was they would license, GE and I think Westinghouse would license their technologies to second countries that hadn't signed the non-proliferation treaty, and the sales would go through those countries. I mean, the history of nuclear proliferation is really one of the United States companies sell, mm-hmm. you know, through various means to get around the treaties and the agreements that were signed to do. And now we're in this situation, and now the U.S. is the arbiter. I mean, North Korea, let's face it, North Korea has not been obliterated because it has. I mean, it truly is an evil regime. I would say, if you just look at how the people suffer, but you know, they get to sit down with the president of the United States and so on because mm-hmm. they have it. Do you think they would ever get rid of it? And Iran is not supposed to be allowed to have, even now when they're talking about possibly, you know, there have been discussions about helping Saudi Arabia get nuclear technology. I mean,
Christina, do you think we are being told a fraction of what's really going on? Do you think that anything that we are allowed to even talk about is what's really going on?
Well, no, because don't you think, I mean, he was talking, remember Tarita was talking about the secret negotiations going on
right.
between Obama
right.
and the Iranians, and how the opposite was being portrayed
right.
in the news, how, you know, Obama squeezed them and so on, but that's not what was going on behind the scenes. No,
right.
we don't know. And this, you know, fantasy or these narratives, false narratives that are constantly projecting, we're fighting these big wars against these evil countries, or we need to fight these wars against these evil countries.
Yeah, like, when does it stop, right? When does the United, when are we not
I don't know.
Fighting or maybe going to threaten?
It's not going to stop until there's no money in it for the people making these decisions. I mean, if we didn't have wars, where would the Pentagon be right now? I mean, what would happen to their budget? I know you don't care,
yeah.
But I'm just telling you, I mean, a lot of these conflicts are, you know, obviously they're business-based, resource-based, you know?
Yes.
And I don't, this is going to sound sort of kind of airy-fairy or whatever, but it's almost like a transformation of consciousness has to occur,
yes,
before people say, you know what? I don't want Iran's oil. I don't want Venezuela's oil.
That's why I thought it was interesting that Trump was talking about how we don't need these regions. We don't need their oil. We don't need their, what did he say? We don't need the Straits.
Well, then Exxon.
Yeah.
You know, what would Exxon say?
But which one is going to win is what's interesting. In him, those conflicting, which one is likely to win? And that's where I come back to.
Well, I'll tell you what scares me based on...
They all want the legacy. None of them want a rotten war.
Yeah, but, you know, well, the Bush legacy, you know, he got a rotten war and he and his buddies got rich. Okay.
Well, that's true.
So, maybe what scares me is, you know, Trump may not want to, although they say in the past that if you're in the middle of a war, they're going to reelect you as president, you know, but okay, say he doesn't want a war right now because he thinks it's not going to help him get reelected. What happens if he does get reelected? Is it okay to have a war then? I mean, you know, these are terrifying things because these people who are making these decisions, you know, they have the resources to survive or to go or whatever. And
I mean,
and
he
take
might
care
be pushed into it, but he's not a hawk. He's not interested in wars. He never has been. He's interested in deals and business.
Well, I know.
Whatever else one may say about him, that is reassuring to me that he just doesn't have a war-mongering mindset. He doesn't understand he says it all, often, and I think he's correct about this. He says, I have common sense. I'm a common sense kind of guy.
He has common sense.
He says he has common sense, meaning does this make sense to do this? Does this make sense for America? Does it make sense for our economy? Does it make sense? Going to war with Iran makes no sense whatsoever.
It makes no sense not only for our economy, makes no sense for the world economy. If the world economy tanks, our economy tanks, you know, just, and you know, we just had a tanked economy situation with that Wall Street crash, you know, back in 2008. We don't want to, you know, we had a recession.
I'm predicting he's going to resist this.
Well, I hope you're right. But what I also hope is if he resists it and it doesn't happen, it would be very, very nice if somebody, some individual, some leader would emerge from this who would say, we need a foreign policy that makes more sense, a foreign policy for the entire world.
With lessons learned, as they like to say, from the post 9/11 decade,
yeah,
of wars.
Well, I mean, 9/11 was the spark that lit all these fires, right?
Right. But we never talk about, do we regret the war in Iraq, for example? Do we regret? We don't talk about that.
It's worse than that. We don't say, let's examine this war.
What a disaster.
And the reasons why we went to the war, and let's see who we can hold accountable if indeed the reasons were
right.
Specious.
We just,
I mean, nobody
don't talk about it.
It's crazy. It's like being, you know.
Do you ever hear anybody talk about it?
No. No, I don't.
Have you ever seen a single Iraqi on cable news television anywhere?
Well, I told you. I one of the things that I found so crazy was when I published Feet to the Fire, which was a series of interviews with major news executives, major American journalists, and I would ask every one of them, you know, I would say, why did we go to the war in Iraq? And they would, a lot of them would hem, most of them hemmed and hawed and, you know, well, it's complicated. Or I just couldn't get like a straight answer. And I remember, I think it was a McClatchy reporter I asked, I can't remember her name now, but I asked one reporter, I finally said, well, you know, the Iraqis, if you ask them.
Right.
I said, I asked them. I said, if you ask the Iraqis why we went to war, what will they say? And this reporter just laughed and said, oh, they'll say oil. You know? And it's just like, it was so clear to the Iraqis, but it was unclear to all these journalists here in the United States. And why is that? Because you, if you become a prominent journalist, you have to have you have to assume the mindset, you have to don the whole costume,
and
you have to accept the narrative, and you have to contextualize your stories within that narrative.
It's almost it's almost like an outsourcing of your actual brain, and you hook into this global media warmonger brain, and you speak from that.
Do you remember?
And we don't have that brain.
At first, they were going to call it Operation Iraqi Liberation.
Oh, God.
And they changed it to Operation Iraqi Freedom, because Operation Iraqi Liberation was OIL, oil. And that was just too obvious.
Oh, my God.
It was too obvious. So it had to be, it was changed. And, you know, when I spoke to these journalists, I was just always so, when I was interviewing them, you know, with certain exceptions like Chris Hedges and Jim Bamford, national security reporter, with a few exceptions, when I would talk to these people, it was just, you know, whatever the official sources had told them, that's what was acceptable. You know, that was what was reported. And, you know, I mean, it was just, it was kind of terrifying. It was kind of terrifying because how can you, first of all, you're not reporting the truth, and yet you have such reach. You're reaching so many people, you know, and you know, Dan Rather, in the end, he apologized. But, you know, your apology after the fact, because you were scared to report the truth, because that's what he said. You know, we were browbeaten into doing it. People were frightened. And they, you know, it's like, well, you know, I want to forgive you. And I guess I do. But the damage has been done. And the damage is incalculable. And it's continuing today. You know, and that's the thing. When I look at this, and that's why I appreciate somebody like Trita Parsi, you know, he's trying to bring sort of a moderate voice. And I'm not kidding when I say I'd love to see him replace.
Oh, yeah.
You know, be great. I mean, these people, do you think Bolton even knows the history, the entire history of our relationship with Iran?
No.
You know? I mean, does he even speak a foreign language? I don't know. That's another thing. There's like a provincialism.
Yes.
Among the leaders of this country.
Yes.
That is in direct disproportion to the power we hold.
Right.
So we're like this infant.
Yes. Right.
You know, warmongering.
Possessed by some spirit. That nobody can see. Nobody. What is this all about?
Well, it's the American exceptionalism.
Well,
business,
right now, what most people are about is getting the country back on its feet economically, getting our curbing our opioid death catastrophe, things like this. People being able to pay off their children's student loan debts. That's on the street.
That's
what Americans are concerned about.
What they're concerned about. But when they pay their taxes, their taxes are going into these troughs,
right?
You know, for wars to keep the military industrial complex on. The money, their tax money, are not coming back.
And I believe that most people who voted for Donald Trump, part of the reason they did that was because he did not come across like someone who's going to drag us into yet more unnecessary wars. And I stand by that.
Yeah,
that,
but there may be, but the strength, I can't explain
after
it.
How many years has it been since 9/11?
Yes, but, you know, maybe, you know, in the
years.
End.
We've had almost two decades.
I mean, what do you think the calculation is at the Pentagon? Do you think the calculation is, well, yeah.
We're talking about different things. I'm talking about where the pulse of the country, what people want.
Yeah, but what people want is not what's been delivered to them for a very long time now.
I know.
I mean,
so what can we do? We're given this one thing we can supposedly do, which is vote.
Well, I mean, honestly, I'm not encouraging people to do anything, you know, illegal or anything, because I believe in the rule of law.
I mean, I think Trump is
the only other thing they control is our tax dollars.
Right.
You know, if you don't put money into the system, they don't have the money, you know, but,
Well, Thoreau said, you know, if you find a law to be intolerably immoral, then break it.
Well, perhaps, but
go to jail.
You know, I mean, people. This is the most propagandized population on earth. I don't know.
But at the end of the day, what do you think is likely to happen, Christina? There's all kinds of fear we could put out there. That's everything is nerve wracking. But what do you think is likely to happen here?
That's the whole point of this show. I don't know, because it's so
crazy. Yeah.
And I'm just talking about it because I'm trying to talk.
I think Trump's pattern is that he waves a big stick and then he backs down, and he does that as his negotiating tactic to drum up a lot, you know, to brandish the stick and then pull
back.
Yeah,
but if he pulls back and doesn't do his war, do you think that forces will move against him in the press and elsewhere?
He's used to that.
To make sure he is not reelected. This man did not.
Well, that would be Google who's going to do that.
Well, I don't know who, but I have some ideas, but I'm not even going to go there. But my point to you is, if he doesn't do what is wanted of him, would these powerful forces then take their considerable resources and power and, you know, use...
That taps into the question of who do you think is behind him, really? Who pushed him up through the, you know, and was it the warmongers, or was it the other guys? You know, I think he doesn't really come from a warmongering root system.
No, but maybe it was thought that, you know, he would see the light of day once in the presidential chair.
See, I would call that faction the globalist faction.
Yes.
And Trump so far is holding pretty firm as he's not a globalist, but
well,
they're trying to turn him into one.
We will see.
We will see.
We will see. We've come to the end of our show here.
How did you know that? You know everything.
No, I
don't. You have a clock.
I was looking at
Jesse,
the time.
Did Jesse? There's Jesse.
Yeah.
2 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, is he giving us 2 minutes? We can keep going.
Oh, it's Alex. Hi, Alex.
No, because I think that if he doesn't bend to that will, I don't know what can happen, you know, I don't know.
If he does not bend to it, he will be very popular with the American people.
Well, I hope so.
Maybe not the press,
yeah,
and maybe
but
not the string pullers.
Yeah, but you know what? The press still has a lot of sway in setting the mindset of the American people. Be very, let's understand.
Okay,
they
not
still
people
do.
I know, but.
Yes, but, you know, don't let that, just because you're in that bubble, don't let that... You know,
But Christina, don't you think the press, it just hates him across the board no matter what he does. So if he starts a war, they'll be against the war. If he doesn't, they'll be for the war.
You're not talking about sort of logically looking at situations or logically looking at, we hate the Iranians. We should go kick their asses. But whatever. At the same time that you dislike Trump, you can hold those two thoughts in your head. And as a matter of fact, it would make, you might still love Trump, but you might be disappointed in him that he didn't go to war that headspace.
I think the mainstream media is hemorrhaging impact, influence, listeners, readership. Not fast enough for my taste.
And either. I find it super interesting that we still can't get to the bottom of what exactly happened with that tanker, that tanker incident out there.
I feel like we can't get to the bottom of anything anymore.
Well, I think it's bizarre we can't get to the bottom of that. I mean, the Pentagon, of course, put out this
if you weren't there,
video.
If
they
you
put
weren't
out
there and saw it with your own eyes, you really have no idea what happened.
Yeah, but you know what? If you were a good investigative reporter, you'd be out there. You'd be going to Iran. You'd be going to the Middle East.
And who would pick up your story?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because at some point somebody will. If you actually spoke to one of those, you saw all those guys lined up. Okay. Lined up in that little boat near the big hole.
Mm-hmm.
If you could get one of those guys, and you could get to them, you can always dig to
that
point.
All right, let's go. You and me.
Okay.
I don't know who else is going to do it. All right. We'll see you next week. This is the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Celia Farber.
I'm Christina Borgeson.